So there is still space if anyone wants to have it stretch out. Are there any questions or anything anyone would like to share? Okay, so I'll start, but if you have questions, let me know, and we'll pause and hear them. I assume you do have questions, but you don't feel like asking them. Okay. I'd like to start with a line from a poem by Denise Levertov, who's actually originally from this place and then moved over to that place, the United States. And I just want to read this line and kind of give it a chance to percolate during the rest of the dialogue. It's called In the Woods. Everything is threatened. But meanwhile, everything presents itself. The trees, that day and night, steadily stand there. And then she goes into more detail of what she sees in the trees and so on. Everything is under threat. Everything is threatened. But meanwhile, everything presents itself. There's a social psychologist who has been doing work for decades now, and I only came across her last week. And she's very practical. She's called the mother of mindfulness, but it's not the mindfulness of Asia. She kind of came up with it herself, and then it so happened that meanwhile, the more Asian versions of mindfulness came across and have gotten so popular. And one example of her kind of mindfulness is if we're in a situation, including a relationship with someone, which we all are, doesn't have to be a certain kind of relationship. She suggests just to notice 5 things about the person that you've never noticed before. And it's not just for someone that you just met last week. It's like those especially of us whom we've known all our lives, that we've lived together for 20 years or whatever. There are still 5 things you can notice about that person that you've never noticed before. And also tomorrow, another 5 things that you've never noticed. And she does scientific research on how this kind of, what she calls active noticing, is enlivening. So for the physiology and also for the love. And including wisdom, not only love, like hugging everybody, but love that can say no as well as yes. And I wonder how it would be to apply that to ourselves, that person that we spend most time with, and maybe in some ways know less well. And so if we can have this exercise of Dr. Langer or Langer, I don't know, as a practical reference point for the rest of the talk. And if I could even give a few more of her examples, sometimes she meets sort of business executives. And she starts by saying, how much is 1 + 1? And some people don't even bother to bite, but some people will say 2. And she says, yes, sometimes. And she has many examples, but her easy example is if you have a piece of chewing gum that's been chewed, and you have another piece of chewing gum that's been chewed, and you put them together, you have one piece of chewing gum. So it has some wide-ranging esoteric meanings, but it's also very practical. And so it's that waking up out of our assumptions and our answers to where we know that we don't know, that interesting things can happen that are enlivening. And then coming more directly into it, the spiritual, there are some wonderful short directions from some of our teachers, some human beings that went far and deep and had words for it. That can help us find our way in that state of knowing I don't know. And not giving up. Not using that as an avoidance. Because we could say, well, I know I don't know, so I'm out. And so Gautama Buddha, one of my favorite of his lines, which is saying a lot, because he has a lot of good lines, is that things are not as they seem. Which we can all go, yes, of course, things are not as they seem. So, but he doesn't stop there. Things are not as they seem, and they're not different. Things are not as they seem, and they're not different from what they seem. It gives us a chance to actually experience in our body mind that it's not we don't have to go a long way away from ourselves to find out what's important. Things are not as they seem, and they're not different. And so it's in that seeming that there's some trouble. The way that we take it in, things seem to be a certain way that they're not at all. But things aren't different from that either. It's not a long way away. In the Isha Upanishad, there's 2 verses that are talking about not knowing. And they give us a way to feel a precise knowing that I don't know. So it's not just giving up or disconnecting because I don't know. So the subject is the Great One. Isha. And they say it is different from knowledge, different also from what you do not know. So what's great, what makes life worth living, is different from knowledge, And it's also different from what you don't know. It's also then another verse, three verses later, come back again, different from what you can see, different also from what goes unseen. This we hear from the steadfast ones who opened our eyes, is the refrain in that. It's different from knowledge, different also from what you don't know. This we heard from the steadfast ones who opened our eyes. Different from what you can see, different also from what goes unseen. This we heard from the steadfast ones who opened our eyes. To bring in that, the refrain, that we could hear something from someone who has a steadiness, a steadfastness, a not giving up, an unshakability. That first of all, is within human possibility. And that being steady doesn't necessarily mean shutting up. There could be a steadfastness and staying true to what's important, and sometimes giving words that help open eyes. To know something that's different from what's seen and what goes unseen. So some other kind of eyes, or some other kind of way with our eyes. And in my experience, it's like a feeling that we could accept that we're in an impossible situation and we don't need to give up. It's impossible. We're threatened and yet present ourselves, just like everything else. It's impossible how vulnerable we are. It's impossible to bear all the information that we have and also all the information we don't have. It's impossible to know how to go from here happily. And yet, there's a potential we hear. That with the threat, with the vulnerability, with the knowing too much and too little of the wrong kinds of things, or in the wrong kind of way, or something. Because it's not knowledge and it's not what you don't know. It's coming out of those frameworks and that it's possible that we kind of melt out of our frameworks. Into another way. We could say another way of knowing, but we don't know yet what kind of other way it is. It's another way. I remember being at college a long time ago. Luckily. And I was very interested in meditation, but it was not like now. There weren't meditation classes everywhere from so many traditions and non-traditions. There weren't any meditation classes that I knew of. There were just the Hare Krishnas, and I wasn't going to go there at that point. Though I have friends who did, and it was good for them for that amount of time that they did. And so I went to college and started studying religion of the world. And in one class, there was a film and an interview with a monk. And he was trying his best to explain one of the most fundamental ideas of Buddhism, which is that things change, that there's not something that always stays the same. And I was in the class really wanting to understand and really wanting to like the class and really wanting to like Buddhism, because at that point, that was the way I could get my meditation. And so he described, his example was you sit in a chair, and at first it might be a really comfortable chair. He was sitting in a chair that someone had made comfortable for him. And he said, but after a while, it won't be comfortable anymore. And I was like, yeah, so? So what? But I just put that aside for, I was like, that doesn't, maybe there's just some communication gap in the language and also the medium and classroom film. But I do think it's actually quite a fundamental misunderstanding that we can take on so easily. Not only in coming into contact with Buddhism, but in coming into contact with life. Coming into contact with the fact that things do change. So the anicca or anicca, the anicca, the non eternity. But isn't it that we just have not yet found the way to be in that flow of things? The fact that things are so fluid. The fact that every life ends. And the fact also, if we come away from the more Buddhist tone of the death and suffering and illness side of things, also things come out of seemingly nowhere. People keep getting born, and animals and grass keep sprouting. It keeps presenting itself. And if we go into through the door of Buddhism, then the fact that things change, that we can't count on something to be there tomorrow, it might be, might not be. We can't count on it to be there. We can't count on you to be there or my mind to be there. I have a friend who woke up during college from one night to the next day, and she was crazy. And she disappeared. And her sister went and found her. If we go into the Buddhist tradition, then that fact that things keep changing, coming and going, is a calling towards another approach, rather than a kind of resentment, or because things are changing, we should just keep our distance from things. So the misunderstanding is we should somehow keep our distance or get safe because things have this nasty, inbuilt quality of changing all the time. And it's not fair, and it's not right, and it's not just, and it's not, and so we have to protect. And it is of concern that it's so easy to take some of the Asian teachings, including a lot of the Buddhist tradition, not as a calling to come into in a different approach that's in harmony with how things are, which is partly that things change, It's so easy that we take it as, oh, we need to, because we're threatened, we need to keep our distance or get some kind of control over. And so there's either the pull away from your relationships because it's too messy, rather than find a way in the relationships that works with the forces that are at play. Or control your mind would be the misunderstanding of the teachings. Control the mind so it's not so gruesome or annoying or whatever it is. Messy, basically. So there is some training towards letting the mind have a break and not be required to be so active and outgoing all the time. And the mind can feel the relief of not having to be on guard all the time. But also coming in contact with the mind in a wholly different way that works with the fact of change. So if we can kind of get the taste of what is the approach that makes it a problem that things change. Why do things keep going wrong? We feel hurt and afraid. And we get tangled up in our own protection. What tangles us up? So one simple example would be, let's go with meditation posture. It can really help to hear what other people's experience has been in their meditation posture so that we can come out of our assumptions. So it can be really helpful to hear instructions for meditation posture and even to look at art that shows people meditating. To what? Then what do we do with that? If what we do with that instruction from images, art, from words, is try to control or try to copy, try to impose some kind of structure on the body, then how does that go? Does it go towards meditation, actually? If our wish was a meditation posture, does trying to sit in a way that I've seen or heard or the way everybody else is, does that go towards meditation or not? In what way does it yes, in what way does it no? And so by stretching ourselves to accommodate other people's experience, we might discover things in our own body that maybe having the back more or less straight is really helpful, but that the back could be straight horizontally as well as vertically, for example. Feeling gravity as part of the meditation posture can be really helpful to hear suggestions. But especially in as much as we could listen for what resonates. So that means sometimes trying something to feel how it resonates. Or sometimes from the very beginning, I'm not sure how this is going to work, but that resonates with me. Or that sounds good, but it doesn't resonate with me. And so if we're here listening for what resonates, then we're also practicing waking up a different kind of sense from the inside. that is an aliveness that could bring us into a posture, like invent, discover. Not necessarily all at once like that, maybe, but often a little shift happens by almost mistake or accident, or maybe on purpose, and then, whoa, that was a really good meditation. I could feel the ground for the first time in my life. Or I felt the real sensuousness of the out-breath in a way that I'd never felt before, and that feels precious. And then let's see if that different experience of gravity with lying on my back with my legs up was part of that. And then so we kind of fumblingly discover. It's not a superheroic discovery usually. And as we start to trust not only what comes from outside, but also what happens by accident and from inside, we're moving away from the kind of stilted beginnings into more of a skillfulness and art, where the use of force is unneeded most of the time. And we can just feel that unnecessary force fall away like bricks falling down from a building and leaving space, leaving transparency that at first is hard to feel even. But gradually we start to recognize that as our kind of real lifeblood. Space and transparency, like the light can kind of fall in. And then we hesitate less with an inspiration that comes from inside to follow through on saying something or doing something or leaving something out that's extra, not doing something, not saying something. We can kind of fall in love with doing way less, both in the micro world of my meditation posture, for example, and even at work and in relationships that maybe even need work, but we can find that doing way less is one of our big challenges and one of the most helpful aspects of the art of being human. So we start to notice that as we get really in touch with how much things are happening and changing, moving by themselves, there's way less that we need to do. And there's also way more in another way. Do you want to ask?
Is that kind of like the same as being still? Like on the teaching of be still? Because that's something I've kind of been exploring. Does it sound the same to you?
You mean in the sense of hearing an instruction that could be helpful and unhelpful, both. Like, it could be helpful, like, oh, I never thought of just actually staying still that long.
Well, not actually being still when you're meditating, but on a sort of bigger level, just mm-hmm. being still within one's life.
Mm-hmm.
So everything's happening in life, going to work, having relationships, but something inside is... I don't know, I've just been kind of playing with it myself,
yeah.
And it sounds a bit like what you're talking about.
Yes. Yeah. And with the two sides of any phrase, where be still resonates with you, and which means it describes your experience and gives you something, a way to kind of leverage open that door where stillness is allowed. Because it's also already here somehow. Discovering stillness already here and leaving a little more room for that stillness to kind of waft around. But then the kind of dangerous side, let's say, is where then I might have ideas of be still.
Mm. That sort of happens with most things that I find.
Yes.
Some part of
Yes.
Kind of latch on to them.
And so even that relationship to helpful phrase or instruction, we can use as an example for what I want to express. We could explore the two words, be still, for a lifetime. It could be. And the way that that would stay alive and helpful is that it wouldn't be staying the same the whole time. It wouldn't be my that same experience of be still that I had that first day coming back, trying to get that again. But where that experience has a chance to grow and spread out and unfold and drop off that sort of, let's say, unnecessary ideas of stillness, unnecessary busyness, etc. And so where usually our attention goes to what's a problem or what's difficult, that calls our attention easily. But when we have a, when we resonate with an instruction or a phrase, whether it came from in or out, be still. Without the freak out, without the nervousness of that would be there if something's wrong and we pay attention, but with the same kind of power of interest in how alive this is, the experience of playing with the words be still. So that we can feel how my experience of that last week and last year and 10 years ago keeps outgrowing itself. Yet somehow we can feel there's a rhyming. It's not like necessarily a big dividing line very often. Sometimes there can be that, oh, this is stillness. Like, I never experienced stillness before. It's so still. That can happen. It does happen. But there's a lot of smaller shifts that can go on. And if we kind of welcome that, which means a kind of fearlessness or willingness to trust or go along with that inner resonance more than the idea. And so that's an example of moving with, and we could say working with, this fact that things change as not a problem, but wonderful. It's alive. It's not that our goal was to sit in that comfortable chair forever, just because it was comfortable for the first 5 minutes, that we're stuck there. Is there any other question or anything to say in this pause?
I can't help but feel then when you say, oh, this is stillness, that there's still some kind of a division of stillness good, old concept of stillness bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This kind of dualistic valoration of still trying or valuing something more than something else.
Mm.
That today's meditation was not still is fine, and today's meditation what felt stiller than ever is also fine, you know?
Yeah. Well, the word still is a good one to play with in that.
Hmm.
And the fearlessness as another word for the same thing. When I'm interested in whether I'm doing it right or wrong, I'm not still. I'm not in that growing organic flow of stillness that's going to keep teaching me stillness. I'm not really in touch with me anymore, or with life. I'm in touch with my idea. And as I let myself be disinterested in right, wrong, better, worse, as a mode, which is a kind of survival strategy, is a kind of trying to protect in this threatening, impossible situation. So we can, with kindness and understanding, compassion, forgiveness, like, okay, when that worry of if I got it right or wrong comes up, okay, like a hurt animal, not who we want to have directing. Being in the stream where things are changing and there's a kind of giving myself fully into that stream as opposed to trying to observe the stream and see how it's going. So that's fear or not fear. That's watching myself or being myself. In the being myself, the discovery of a stillness that I never felt before is possible in a way that's almost impossible if I'm occupied with watching myself, which means I'm divided in myself. It needs all of me to be there for that. And there, from my measuring mind, it sounds like the same thing, like, oh, well, that's better, so I've got to get better in them. But in the experience, we could also say it is better. But it's not possible for me to have that experience when I'm worried about it being better or worse. And so it's giving up better or worse that better can happen, kind of. And we can't trick ourselves into that. But with compassion for how dearly we would like it to be better because we're so sure that something's wrong, is just also part of things being messy, not how they seem, but not different. And when I say it's better, I mean a couple different things. One is, first of all, to allow ourselves to have a new experience that I recognize as new is so humbling because I never had it before, however old I am. So people say, and I have the privilege of being on retreat, and people will come of every age, including teenage, up into their 70s and 80s, all the way between. I'm such and such an age, and I can't believe I never noticed that before. And it's like just so good that timeless noticing could happen at any age. And so when I'm so worried that I'm not good enough, and I'm trying so hard to be better, it's almost impossible for me to allow an experience like that that's new, that I've never had before, because then it would be confirming that I've been wrong and I've not been good enough. And so it's edgy because it's humbling, but it is juicy and it is real. So all the experiences of stillness all along. And as they grow closer to home, so we could say there seems to be, and these words are very tricky because it can so easily trigger that feeling that, oh, I don't have it. But more authentic, or have more, the experiences seem to have more authority or authenticity. Our willingness to use force starts to fall away more and more. And this an experience of interpermeability starts to happen that's can feel like threat and is powerful. So powerful to let that much power be present in our own experience that often we'd rather go back, build the walls again and feel small. But to be that cracked open building or nutshell or whatever, that the light can come in. It's not good how we imagine good is going to be. When we think good is going to be, I'm going to feel finally protected and safe and I won't feel under threat anymore and I can just present myself. And it's in the knowing of our vulnerability and that there is threat, so to say, and yet, and meanwhile, keeps presenting itself. So I talked about the possibility of deep ease as a core of our lives. And that's letting where it's not that we can do it on purpose, but we gradually grow to lose our addiction to feeling there's something wrong with me and I've got to get better, or there's something wrong with the world and we've got to make it better first, and then we can live. And we just accept there's a lot of things wrong and a lot of things right. We don't have to, cut those words out and never use them again. But maybe we just get on with it, at least, instead of postponing. So there's the doing way less, because things are doing themselves, and then there's also this great willingness to do way more, which sometimes is just do way more by being way more present. With the impossibility, with the fact that everything dies and suddenly something also is born. And even quite specifically with accepting how the timing of challenging passages in our lives, it often seems to happen at just the wrong moment, we would say. Just part of why the inconvenience of that challenge is part of why it's challenging. But it seems like it's almost, we can kind of move with the fact that here comes that unexpected challenge that seems to be more than I can do. That's why it's challenging. If we can feel it as kind of like life wringing us out, it's like wringing out some unnecessary effort somewhere. And so a kind of willingness to be wrung out of what's extra. And so even in the accepting challenges as more like life saying you can, even though there's a feeling that I can't and I never have before and so on. But if we can feel our way into and through challenging passages, partly doing way less, so being still, but being willing to be a person that you weren't before. You weren't that. Yesterday you couldn't. And today you are actually doing it. And it doesn't mean alone, without help, etc. And in that, whatever took any extra energy unnecessarily, so even the little bit unsustainable, is much more clear. And can fall away. Whereas if we had to kind of retrain ourselves in a normal, unchallenging passage, it could take a lot longer. Does that make sense? So in our impossible situation, there can be the deep acceptance of what we don't like. And I love Byron Katie's teachings on this, especially when she uses a lot of examples of being in relationship with people. And how most of what needs to change is, maybe 80% of what needs to change or more, is my expectation that you're going to start acting how I want you to. And she says it's like expecting the cat will bark or the dog will meow, which could happen. So, I mean, maybe it has happened, but it's just so not likely to happen. And letting that be my work to stop expecting the cat to bark leaves some space for some things to shift. And at the same time, it's impossible because it's not only deep acceptance of how things are and how they aren't like what we want always, or even when they are how we want them, we stay tuned to how alive that is, and it keeps changing. So we can't just stop somewhere. Even with deep acceptance of things not being how we want, and that's like a full acceptance that we grow into. There's also a full acceptance of the potential of any situation to go in any direction. And one of my more easy, simple, and true examples is just my landlady one time, who was a control, she lived upstairs and I lived downstairs, and she's Indian and I'm not, and different ideas of how things could be done. But I just kept feeling, okay, but let's just pretend, let's play with this thought, we could be best friends. And what one of the small things that happened that I noticed, the relationship changed immediately. And one of the small things that I can say happened is that because I had that thought, I thought, oh, she loves roses. And there's all these roses now in the market for 10 rupees. I'll just buy her a little rose. You know, it's in a dirt ball. It's not even in a pot. And she was so happy. Mm-hmm. Still has the rose kind of thing. So as the unnecessary doing, like we almost had taken it as our job to cover up the fact that things change, as if it's something wrong, and so we've got to either stop it or hide it. And that was taking up so much of our energy, that as we start to come into the fact that things are in a flow, our very experience of our body that seems so solid is in our actual experience only a flow, a stream of flashes of experience. We start to acknowledge, so meet, acknowledge, and come into ourselves, we could say. The word our voice comes to me today. We come into our voice. So there's less holding back on our actual genuine inspiration. Instead of postponing that one thing at the bottom of every list and never getting around to it, we start to just do it, or to just not do it, or to say it or not say it in our own way. It's a kind of living flame in us, in people. And we can appreciate how much we like, I think, to hear each other's voices. Not only the spoken voice, but just the presence. And how great that it's absolutely different in each person. And that difference doesn't in any way make a gap between us. So as we hold back less that kind of genuine movement, the use of force is less and less necessary and way less interesting. So trying to control or copy or whatever. And then our experience can be still unpredictable, fluid. We're not, we didn't manage to stop anicca. We didn't manage to stop the shiftiness and change. But I think we come in touch with two layers of being human. And one is this sort of interpermeability that's a lot like the way scientists describe. I can't say I know the science, but I've heard scientists describe when two surfaces come close to each other. So like you on the ground, or you with your clothes, or your hands together. That it's really slush and slush interpermeating. So there's that experience with everything, interpermeation, if we can say, which seems to allow an incredible amount of detail to come in that otherwise we don't receive. And it can come in because it comes in not through our thinking filter. But it can come across and, first of all, just meet, which in and of itself is fulfillment. And then not only meet, but from the meeting comes some kind of richness. So you may have had times of your life where you were blown away by good or by bad experience. Someone, you lost someone. Or you felt awash with appreciation for the light on the flower in the evening or whatever. And we can feel that it can be shocking. It feels as if we could feel the breath of the rose breathing in us or something like that. And that's the kind of language that's in the spiritual texts. For them, that's real. That's the reality. That's what is. And so our willingness to breathe with or be breathed with something that's in everything, but not locked in there and not only there. First of all, there's the meeting. Second of all, there's a power. And third of all, a responsiveness that can happen. That's way kinder and more intelligent than we seem to be, as what we were taught to be. So both kinder and more intelligent. And there's another line from the Isha Upanishad who says, who is cunning? So who is clever? Who is intelligent enough towards loss and creation? With loss crosses death. With creation reaches the deathless. So going along with the fact that everything dies and letting that not be the end of the world or a problem, letting death not be a problem, and being more clever with that fact. So actually just seeing, really meeting the fact. With loss, we cross death, so we come into fearlessness. We come into what doesn't take death seriously. And if we also don't stop there, but we notice that things also appear as if out of nowhere, including thoughts, including bodies, including everything. It comes as if out of nowhere. And we meet that impossible fact. We don't just cross death, but we reach the deathless. And so then it's not a struggle to try to be detached. It's a real resting in the stillness of our depth that doesn't know how to attach. It doesn't know how to be affected by or wounded by. And so we can be with this, how vulnerable we are and with how invulnerable we are, how destructible and how indestructible, and meeting each other in those two ways at once, not dividing it. Then we meet each other. We're not saying, oh, there's nothing personal. We feel even more the personal. Because also it's not a threat anymore to be personal. And we don't mind death. And so our meetings can be both more personal and way more deep. And in the depth, it's almost not a meeting anymore. It's something that already is together, just acknowledged as being that together. Everything is threatened, but meanwhile, everything presents itself. The trees, that day and night, steadily stand there. So not just the steadiness or steadfastness of the fact that things keep presenting themselves. So not the same tree, but a different tree 2,000 years later. Not only that, that's almost like a sign or a poetry about something that's that still and that unchanging. That's not a something, but we have access to that in our in every experience, in every day. So we've come to the end of our time, and I'm happy to stay around for 5 or 10 more minutes if anyone has a question. And I just want to mention again the boxes that are there in the porch next to the delicious goji berry. This is all language we don't even speak in Spain. What? organic goji berries with raw cacao. Yes. Available to munch on. And the donations is part of a tradition and a joy, a tradition and a way of being in harmony with what is, the way life is. Life's so generous, giving so much more than we could possibly handle as a single person. And so I've had the chance my whole life, except for about 6 weeks that I did a temp job in an office. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but almost my entire adult life, I've been supported by gifts only. And that's still the case, even with 2 kids and cars that keep breaking down and taxes to pay and all that. So it's really a joy to come together in this way, especially since the retreat sort of has covered the expenses and Caroline's and allowing us in your home with Caroline and Mike. So I really appreciate any gifts that you feel to give into the donation boxes that I hope to share a bit as well with Caroline and Mike. And that's what supports my family and has allowed me to come here and would allow me to keep spending all my working hours making this kind of thing possible. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you.